Okay, well, we're back now, having survived a fire alarm in our previous class, and we were talking about intelligence, and I mentioned it. Certainly, we're going to continue right now to talk about it, but I think the first thing I want to ask you is, you know, when you think about intelligence, what do you think it is? When I say to you, what is intelligence, or what is IQ, what is it? Mr. Opuni?
I've heard about, like, people say there are flaws in, like, the present IQ testing. Mm-hmm. So, like, there's like, a different kind of test to test you in different levels. Like, you can have intelligences in different areas. Like, they say, like, Shakespeare had intelligence, like, in terms of his writing. And they said Newton had, you know, intelligence in terms of his, in terms of the sciences. So there are different intelligences that should be tested, not just one IQ test.
Okay, great. Now, Mr. Opuni has just taken one side of the argument, which is intelligence refers to specific abilities. And he used good examples. I mean, that Shakespeare may have had a great ability to be creative and write. Perhaps he wouldn't have done well as a mechanical engineer. What else do you think about when you think about intelligence? Do you think about it the way Mr. Opuni just described it? Okay. Okay. This is a good point. If we were to talk in statistical terms, you might be saying intelligence for you is kind of correlated with experience and wisdom. So that, and we often talk about people like that. You know, we talk about people who don't have much schooling, but they seem to have a lot of wisdom. I mean, we go to them for answers, and we kind of marvel at the fact that the person actually seems to know a lot, yet you wouldn't derive that from the fact that the person got it in school, but they seem to have something that enables them to perhaps have insights the rest of us don't have. Okay, what else? Sure, Mr. Jones. Okay, now, that's a very different way to look at it. Mr. Jones is saying IQ might refer to your capacity to learn. Now, do you think that if it does do that, then that probably if you're a very bright person, you could learn whatever it is you want to learn? Okay, so you would take the position that intelligence is kind of a general factor. That is that if you're real bright, it just depends on what you're motivated to learn. Mr. Opuni would not take that position. His position would be, you may be very bright in and talented in one area. It doesn't necessarily mean, as I said, you know, in other words, you might be able to write and be creative, but it doesn't necessarily mean you'd be able to do well in a highly mathematical field like engineering. Okay?
Yeah, but they said there are also people that have, like, that are gifted and have intelligences in all these areas. Like they said, Da Vinci was an example of that. So you can you know, be, you know, like the typical, like, Renaissance, you know, if you say Renaissance man, Renaissance woman, or whatever. So you don't have to be, like, limited by that one field, but you shouldn't just focus on just one.
Uh-huh. Okay, now Mr. Opuni has expanded the definition, saying, and this is very interesting. Perhaps, even if you took the position that you have, that there are specific intelligences, you might have a whole bunch of them. And Da Vinci would be a good example. So perhaps, you know, you have a superior ability to be creative, a superior ability in art, but you might also be able to, you might have the ability, if you really wanted to use it, to learn to build bridges. So, and this is the controversy now. The controversy is, whether or not, and if we can have the first slide, you'll see, there is a G factor theory. The G factor theory is the one presented by Mr. Jones. That is, you have a general ability, and it's really a matter of how you apply your intelligence that will cause you to perhaps be, you know, very superior in one area rather than another. And this thesis, you know, really holds. I mean, if you really do have considerable intellectual ability, it's really a matter of where you want to go. Now, the S-factor theory, which is Mr. Abuni's theory, is that you really can divide intelligence into a lot of intellectual functions. In fact, people have come up with as many as 150 intellectual functions, of which you may have some, but not the others. Now, the controversy isn't settled. And I think that, you know, you can think about this yourself. Do you find that you can fix your own car? After all, everybody in this room, very bright, all getting college degrees. Perhaps some of you, or even all of you, may be going on for graduate degrees. But can you fix your car? And do you think, even if you can't fix your car, do you think you could learn to fix your car? After all, you're doing well in all these academic subjects, but can you do that? Can you cook? I mean, how many of you are as good at cooking as you are at taking these courses? How many of you would be embarrassed if you had to cook? Don't have any idea how to cook. Or you know that better to buy lean cuisines and not run risks. Pardon?
I said whether or not you can cook depends on who you ask.
Yeah, well, okay.
I think I'm good. My mother-in-law doesn't.
Okay, so you have complicated this issue by saying that it may be the perception of others that determines whether you can do something or not. But it is something that you need to be aware of, because we're going to talk about these tests now, and you're going to see that the tests themselves actually take different positions on this theory. That is, some of the tests actually test for specific functions, others test generally. Also, something that gets somewhat confused is intelligence versus abilities. So we tend to think of those as the same. That is, you know, if you are a bright person, then you have all these intellectual abilities. But it is interesting sometimes to see that, some people really struggle with certain tasks. They don't seem to master them easily. The person who decides he or she is going to fix their electric lawnmower. Some people, their lawnmower breaks down, they get down there and they get wrenches and screwdrivers, and they take the thing apart and they see how it works and they put it back together again. Their neighbor has the same problem. Their neighbor gets down there, takes the thing apart, and eventually buys a new lawnmower because they've so destroyed the one they have that they can't put it back together again. Two people who both seem pretty bright people, both very accomplished people. But the question becomes, why? Some would hold that, fixing certain things may be an ability that we can't characterize quite as clearly as we can characterize intelligence. Others would say, no, they're similar, but the reason why one person was more effective than the other was that one person was more patient. So perhaps the first person, very methodically took the lawnmower apart, maybe made a couple of drawings about how things fit here and there, put the pieces down very carefully so when he or she had to put it back together again, they knew how to do it. The other person whipped through it, got it all unassembled, and then couldn't figure out how to put it back together again. It may not have been IQ that was a factor in here. It may have been like organizing ability, the ability not to get too frustrated with a task. So the whole idea in this is that there are lots of complexities. And this is true when we were just talking about psychopathology. We talked about the complexity of that. We talk about IQ. There's a lot of complexity. So what we're trying to do is to get as pure a factor as we can. That is, and in this particular case, we want a useful factor. We want intelligence to be able to inform us about what we can do. And in the case of some people, where you find a person is very bright, you may want to encourage them to aspire beyond what they're doing now. And in the cases of some people, they never knew they were as bright as they are. Grew up in poverty, grew up in circumstances where they weren't encouraged to go to school, always felt they would have a job laboring. They go on and they do labor. Meanwhile, they might be a voracious reader. They've gathered lots of information. They clearly could have gone to college and gone to graduate school, but their circumstances didn't allow for it. And they themselves never thought that they had that kind of ability. Somehow they saw themselves as on one side of the tracks and the people who could do that other thing as on the other side of the tracks. Well, you know, now we discover this phenomena with some people, and we realize that you really want to get those people back, into school if that's what they want to do, because they can excel. This phenomena, by the way, interestingly, was shown after the Second World War. People escaped out of Eastern Europe, and especially Jews, who had been persecuted and actually were very fortunate to not die. Many of them had relatives and family members who died. But all of their records were lost, their school records. And in many cases, people spent years hiding, and they didn't finish a high school, for example. Or they might have had a year of college. They didn't finish. But they did develop this wisdom that we were talking about, you know, where the person having had to be very creative to stay alive and having to actually be very courageous manages to survive the war. They come to the United States. And it was interesting. Some universities recognize this phenomena, and they just let students in. One of the extremes that I was really impressed with was the University of Chicago actually took some people who hadn't been to college or maybe had a year of college. And they had no record, by the way, whether these people actually had or not. But they interviewed them, they tested them, and they let them into graduate school. And I know a couple of people, for example, the only degree they have, the only credential they have, by the way, they don't have any record of grade school, high school. All they have is a PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Chicago. Only credential they have. Well, it was a very, you know, good move to recognize that this would be a waste because of the circumstances that these people were in. If they weren't able to excel when they're very bright, they want to excel, and now why send them back through all of those, you know, why send them back and say, well, we better make sure you get a GED, that you graduate from high school, we better be sure you take all those undergraduate courses, when the person's already 45 years old, has had an incredible life, but they want to give back, and they could be enriched if they were in a specific program. Okay, now I'm going to talk about specific tests. The first is the Stanford-Binet IQ test. And you may recall I mentioned Alfred Binet earlier as a person who developed this test in France, and it was important because it could measure the intelligence of very young children. And it developed that way because many of the tests the content of the early subtests didn't require verbal skills. That is, some of this involved children doing certain things with dolls. It involved them being able to move certain things around or to string beads on a string or various tasks. And you could then determine how much of a task a child should be able to do if the child is 3. And how much on that same test should they be able to do if they're 4. And then if they're 6 or 7, they should be able to do more. And there would be subtest 1, subtest 2, subtest 3, etc. And you would expect that the average child would be able to do these tests at a level depending on their chronological age. Now, the way the test was developed was took what can the average, so-called average 3-year-old do, what can the so-called average, 5-year-old, 10-year-old, and we gave that the term mental age. So we said, your mental age is what you can do on this test. And if you're like the most of the people who are in your age group, you should be able to go this far. Now, we then developed it. The concept of IQ developed by taking this idea of mental age, and then you divided it by your chronological age. So let's say we have a child who's able to do the items on the test up to the level of age 10, and they are 10 years old. So you would divide 10 by 10, you get 1. You multiply by 100, that's how you get IQ. So the average IQ turns out to be 100. Now let's say our 10-year-old actually can do all the tasks up to what a 12-year-old could do, the average 12-year-old. Well, then you take, you know, your 12, you divide it by 10, you get 1.2, multiply it by 100. This child has an IQ of 120. So that's how the you know, statistically speaking, that's how we developed the sense of IQ. It really was the relationship of your chronological age to your mental age, and your mental age was determined by how many tasks you can do on the Stanford-Binet IQ test that are at the age level, the chronological age level that you're at. Now, when we first established IQs, we said that IQ at 100 was the average. And then we said if an IQ was below 70, someone was feeble-minded. And originally, we said if your IQ was 140 or more, you were in the genius range. So these labels were made up. Today, we don't report IQs the same way. That is, we use different modifiers. We talk about a person as either very superior, superior, high average, or the person's average, low average, borderline, and we do still have this term mentally retarded, although in more popular language we tend to talk about people being mentally challenged. Now, if scores are in this mentally retarded range, there are additional modifiers that are used, and this is very important. We talk about people being mildly retarded, moderately retarded, severely retarded, and we even talk about people being profoundly retarded. And those are very important modifiers. That is, we know that even though some people do not have a lot of intelligence, the fact that they have a certain amount means that they can do certain tasks that they wouldn't be able to do if they had yet less intelligence. And so we've now learned that people who we used to just let stay at home for their whole life can actually go out and work if you have a very structured environment and you have very structured tasks and you have a lot of supervision. And there are these shelters or workshops where families are often able to send their adult children who are not bright enough to go to school or to do very well in school, but who can take things like take letters, stuff them in envelopes, close the envelope, put a stamp on it. And so for some company that wants to send out a huge amount of mailings and they don't have the automation to do it, they send them over to this shelter. Now what happens with these people who have low IQ but some functional IQ, first of all, they have a job. You know, and as an adult, that's very important to them. Secondly, they actually earn money. Now the tasks they do don't produce a lot of income to these shelters, so they earn very little money. But the money that they earn you know, creates for them, I mean, a real sense of being a person. It also does give them that sense that they're like other adults, because they are adults. They're just not, they just don't have the intellectual capacity of a lot of adults. And it means that they have structure. They get to leave home every day. They may get on the bus. They may have the ability to, you know, to take the bus to their work and get off the bus and go in. And they have friends. And they have friends that they can talk to and socialize with. The people who run these operations are usually, you know, incredibly empathic people who, you know, are able to recognize just, you know, how much of a task can someone do. And amongst even, you know, your group of people who are mentally challenged, those who are a little brighter may be able to help those who are not so bright. So you get a lot of interaction. Before we started making these distinctions and recognizing that it's very important to do this, there was a sense, if you can't go to school and you can't learn to do a job like, you know, work in the factory, then you're just going to stay at home. So, you know, a great deal was lost. Also, we've learned that if you can determine the mental age of a person, then whatever the average person at that mental age learns, this person can probably learn. So let's say you have a 20-year-old with the mental age of an 8-year-old. Well, start asking yourself, what can the average 8-year-old do? Well, the average 8-year-old can do a lot. Average 8-year-old can, you can send the 8-year-old to the store. 8-year-old can find his or her way to school. Usually they can follow simple directions. They may be able to read. I mean, a lot of things an 8-year-old can do. So if you look at someone not from the perspective of their chronological age, but you look at them from the perspective of their mental age, then you can set expectations. And of course, those expectations will be very different than if you have an adult who only has a mental age of 4. Then you have to start, you know, being much more protective, and there's probably much less that they can do. Now, the concerns about the Stanford-Binet originally were that it's an overly verbal IQ test, even though, as I mentioned, young children have tasks that they can do. But a psychologist named David Wechsler, who actually was the chief psychologist at a very famous place in New York, Bellevue Psychiatric Hospital. And he developed a test specifically for adults, published it in 1939. And it was called the Wechsler-Bellevue Intelligence Scale. It was aimed at adults age 17 and older. And this particular test produced three scores. You got a verbal IQ, which, you know, tended to focus on a person's abstract abilities, a performance IQ, which tended to focus on a person's ability to accomplish certain tasks, and then what it was called a full scale IQ, which was determined by adding these scores together. And that's how you got the full scale IQ. And what became important in that is if one of those IQs was way higher than the other, you began to examine for possible brain damage was the first concern always, because if you score real high in one, the premise always was you're at least that bright. So why can't you do well in the other? And what we found is that you may do poorly in the performance part because you do have some kind of dysfunction, but you also may do poorly in the performance part simply because you're depressed. So someone might not be doing as well in their work. And people might say, well, they don't have the ability to do it. Well, this test might suggest, you know, they do have the ability to do it, but they're so depressed, they don't function well on the job. And so with treatment, this person may be a much better worker. Now, the test has been revised a number of times, and so the one you see up on the slide is what's called the WACE-3. That's the current version of the test. Now, it has 10 subtests, and there's an information subtest, and you can see they start with very simple questions, work their way to much more difficult tests or questions, like you ask, you know, what does bread come from? What does Shakespeare do? What is the capital of France? What is the Malleus Maleficarium? Obviously, many more people will know where does bread come from than will know what is the Malleus Maleficarium. So, and you take the person through these, and all of the subtests are like this. That is, all of the subtests start with simpler items, and they keep going to more complex items, and you stop testing after the person misses a couple of the complex items. Now, that's just information here. You're just getting a general fund of information. Now, the next subtest is called comprehension. And this has questions like, what should you do with a wallet found in the street? Why do foreign cars cost more than domestic cars? And then there are questions like, tell me, what does the squeaky wheel gets the grease mean? Much more abstract, than the first one. You know, what should you do with a wallet you find in the street? It's a very concrete thing. You can visualize it. There's a wallet lying in the street. I mean, what am I supposed to do with it? What does the squeaky wheel gets the grease mean? Obviously, is very abstract. I mean, now you're at the metaphorical level. And there are some people who can answer those first questions, that is, they can deal with the concrete. When you get to the metaphorical, they can't do that. Then there are arithmetic abilities that are examined, starting with things like, if you have four apples and you give two away, how many do you have? So, you know, very simple arithmetical questions. But it may go on to more difficult ones like, if four people can finish a job in 6 days, how many people would it take to do the job in 2 days? So you have to start doing something that might involve very basic algebra, but the idea is it's a much more abstract thing that you have to do. Then, and notice, by the way, as we go through these now, what we're kind of positing is these are separate intellectual functions. The next one is similarities. And this is an abstraction. You know, can you see the similarity between certain things? So you tell the people, identify similar aspects of pairs. And you give them pairs, and you see, can they give you something common, like hammer and screwdriver. And you see, and what do you say? If I say hammer and screwdriver, say tool. That's right. So you had to abstract. You had to come up with a term like that. Portrait and short story. You have to think a little more about that one. Okay, what's going to be your common portrait and short story? We're timing you. I think about this. Okay. The common thing is they're both works of art. I didn't hear you. I'm sorry. Mr. Jones gets credit for this. Okay. How about dog and flower? Okay. They're both living things. Yeah. But you know, if you look at this, you notice how the abstraction gets more difficult as you go along. So that someone may get the earlier one, but I have to do a lot more thinking to get the later ones. Now, then the next one, I won't spend time on it, but there's a thing called digit symbol encoding, in which you show numbers and you show symbols, and the person has to replicate the symbols after the numbers. Then there's memory, like there's digit span. You give the person a group of numbers, like you say, and you usually start with maybe 3, and you say, 6, 5, 8, and the person has to say 6, 5, 8 back. And you get up to as many as 7, and so you give the person, 3, 2, 9, 4, 6, 3, 5, and you ask them to give that back to you. Then to see if they can not only memorize but keep that for a while, you start giving them numbers, say, from 3 to 7, and you ask them to give them in reverse order, to see if they can, hold the concept and then repeat this back to you, but in reverse order. Now, then there's a test of vocabulary. And again, you start off with simple words like chair and dime and lunch. then you get to a little more difficult words like paragraph or asylum, and you get the even more difficult words like cutaneous. What is interesting about vocabulary in our world is that there are 10 or 11 subtests here, but if you wondered, you don't have much time. You can only give one subtest of all of these. You find that vocabulary correlates better with IQ than any of the other subtests. That is, if you're really stuck and you give the person this vocabulary test, and they do well in it, you can assume they're probably pretty bright. If they do poorly in it, you can assume they probably are not especially bright. Now, what you lose, of course, is in using only one test, is you lose all the kind of the fine points you can learn about someone's cognitive functioning by giving all the tests. But it is interesting that we do find that your fund of vocabulary is highly related to how well you do on general tests of intelligence. Now, these first tests I've mentioned to you, tend to be verbal and abstract. Then there are some tests where, the person actually does things. There's a picture completion test where the person is asked to find missing objects in increasingly complex pictures. Then there's a block design where you show the person a design with the blocks, then you toss the blocks to them, and then they have to reassemble the blocks in the design that they saw. Then there's a picture arrangement test where you give the person a group of pictures, like cartoon characters, and they're mixed up. And the person has to take them and put them in an order that tells a story. And often then you make sure you ask them to tell you the story so you can see the logical progression. There are a couple of other ones I won't mention now, but it gives you a feeling for what IQ tests are like, and that we are trying to focus on specific factors that go into developing this broad concept of intelligence. Also, in the WAIS 3, they've actually added new subtests now. They've got a test called verbal comprehension, working memory, perceptual organization, and processing speed. So as we continue to study intelligence, we keep finding things that we think are important enough, and they seem to be independent enough that we should measure them because they tell us something about how someone will be able to function in the real world. Now, the WAIS 3, by the way, is a test that you'll find is used a lot by neuropsychologists. It is not a test that identifies specific types of brain damage. So not doing well doesn't tell you exactly what the brain damage is. But it's helpful in determining areas of exploration with other neurological examinations. So when you find that somebody doesn't have any memory from a subtest, or you find that someone can't do certain abstractions, or you find that they can't do certain concrete activities, it gives clues as to where this person's area of functioning may be a problem. Also, there are other ways in which this test is helpful in neuropsychology. One of them is, if you have a person who has a particularly high IQ, let's say a person has 130, 140 IQ, and they have to undergo neurosurgery, let's say they have to have a tumor removed, and the tumor is near the frontal lobe, they lose some cognitive functioning as a result. So they get tested after the surgery. Before the surgery, you tested them, they were 130 to 140. You test them after the surgery, they're 105. So they've lost a significant amount of the ability they had. And in the subtests, you might be able to determine, what kinds of things that they lose. Now, this person comes in to see the neuropsychologist, and when the person asks them, well, how are you doing? The person says, terrible. I'm dysfunctional. I can't do the things I used to do. I can't go back to work. I don't think the way I used to think. this surgery was horrible. Now, of course, it may have been that there was no choice for the surgery, and the surgery may have been very successful, but one of the outcomes of the surgery was this kind of cognitive loss. Now, why this is important is because if the person has an IQ of 105, they've got as much intellectual ability as the average person. So obviously, they can do a lot. They don't have to give up working, unless they were in some unusual area where they, without all of the IQ they previously had, they couldn't function. What you usually find is the person simply has to take longer to get things done. They may even have to relearn some things that they didn't know. And we have found that people who undergo neurosurgery and who, let's say, have this big drop, let's say a drop from 135 IQ to 105, gain some of it back over the period of the first year that they're healing. So they, and a year later, their IQ may be slightly higher than the 105 that was measured. But what's key in this is when you, if you didn't have these tests and you just listened to the patient, you would assume that the patient really can't do much. In fact, you might tell a patient to go on disability. You know, you can take care of yourself, you can be productive at home, and say a lot of nice things. Of course, it's horrible for the patient. What the tests have shown and what neuropsychologists have been able to do is to then work with people, realizing the cognitive ability they have, to kind of optimize whatever their strengths are. So once they find out what areas, for instance, did the person not lose any function in, they can do things in that area just as well as they could do them before. That you can emphasize those things. In the area where there are deficits, you begin to teach the person things like to be patient, to work more at it, or to emphasize tasks in their work that allow them to use those functions that they do best. But the thing is, as you can hear from me, I'm saying, but this person can go back, be a productive adult, can do a lot of things. This surgery does not have to be a kind of the end of their working life. So the tests are very, very important, and they really have done an amazing amount. Now, the same, by the way, is true for children. Wechsler, there's a Wechsler intelligence scale for children that, and it's really for kids about 5 to 15, and it was revised in 1991. And this test also, by the way, goes back and examines to about age 3. And in the same way that that adults sometimes have, you know, traumatic experiences like having to have neurosurgery, children do too. And if a child comes out of surgery and has lost some cognitive functioning, it's very important to determine what do they have, because that then can help you to guide them. And what are they going to do in school? What will be the next challenges for them? And you want to be sure that they can be effective with those challenges. Now, we're going to leave IQ tests then, and we're going to go on to personality tests. And, you know, there's always been a lot of excitement about personality tests. And clinical psychologists have devoted a lot of attention to developing personality tests. And they've been very helpful as instruments in screening a person's readiness, for instance, for the military. Tests have been used to get a sense of whether a person is really the right person for a high-risk job, like should this person be on a SWAT team, or should this person be in the Navy SEALs? Should this person be allowed to become an explosives expert? If somebody's going to determine are these bombs alive or not? And you might say, well, you know, what would you want to know about somebody who is going to be an explosives expert? Well, what would you want to know? Here you are. You're, you know, the chief of police. You got to get a bomb squad. And you want to know amongst this group of people, a whole bunch of people have volunteered, what would you want to know about someone that you're going to place in the bomb squad? Positively or negatively? Sure. Aha, good one. Mr. Kim says, yeah, you want somebody who's going to stay calm under pressure. Okay? Someone maybe has got some patience. Okay? What else would you want to know? That's a very good one, but might be other things you'd want to know.
Are they a pyromaniac?
Okay. Here, you know, is this someone who perhaps enjoys the outcome of what might happen too much? That's one side of it. By the way, what would be the other side of it clinically? You think? If you have somebody, you're worried about somebody who enjoys this, what also might be, well, this is a fairly significant leap, but what you might be concerned about is you wouldn't want someone who's terribly depressed. That is, you wouldn't want somebody where it wouldn't matter to them if the bomb went off or not. You know, that's not the kind of person you want to have going in there checking and trying to make sure that this bomb doesn't explode. So you can have, you know, personality tests, and they're used in lots of ways to kind of develop a sense, is this person well suited to this task? Because the task is important. You know, FBI uses, if you want to be an FBI agent, you're going to undergo tests, CIA. What do you think that they want to find out about? You're the head of the CIA. What do you want to know about somebody who's a recruit?
Can they keep a secret?
Can they keep a secret? Okay. Pretty important, isn't it? Is this someone who has the discretion and has the inner life that allows them to know important information, but they don't have to share it? Okay. That's one. What else would you want? Oh, sure, Mr. Apuni.
Maybe I don't know mental stamina, because you never know that these agents go to different countries. What if they're captured by, you know, like opposing force, and you know they want to get, like going back to the secret, what if they want to get information out of that person? Can they be able to, you know, refrain from, you know?
Hey, really a tough issue you've raised, yeah. Will the person be able to withstand you know, being interrogated? That's, you know, we have a lot of trouble trying to figure out, can somebody do that? We have a lot of trouble even, you know, saying to somebody this might happen to you. But you do find that with some people, they have the ability at least to kind of disclose information a bit inaccurately. Like if you have that talent, that may be the talent that's most important. People are probably, you're going to be tortured, you're probably going to disclose things. So are you able to disguise some of it? That might be one. Now, supposing your CIA person scores very high on a scale that measures paranoia. Is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? Okay, why is it a bad thing? Yeah.
Kind of speaks for itself. I don't know, but wouldn't want somebody who constantly thought that everyone was out to get them. I can't really explain myself very well there.
Well, no, that. But you're onto it. Why don't you want the person to be terribly paranoid?
Because they would be suspicious of everybody. Everybody would be guilty to them.
Very good.
No,
yeah.
Open-mindedness.
They don't discriminate well enough. They don't, see?
What I know.
See, that's the problem. You know, and sometimes the stereotype of agents are that they're very paranoid. Well, there's a real difference between being inquisitive, insightful, alert, you know, able to see subtle signs, all of which are reality-based, versus being suspicious of everything. So once you reach the second part, then you've lost discrimination. So you want somebody who is discriminating. You also, you know, there are other variables, and I've never done this testing, but I mean, for the CIA or the FBI, but, you know, some are fairly obvious. You want a person who, you know, is comfortable enough living away from home. You want someone who is comfortable within several cultures, because often people are going to deal with people from other cultures. You want, you know, people who have very good social IQs, You know, they're very sharp, perceptive with other people. And there are a lot of other variables that get measured. And the thing about it is we have developed tests to do things like this. Now also, you know, we do have tests of symptoms that we'll talk about in a moment, but the when we use tests of symptoms, often they're very helpful in psychotherapy. You know, you give someone a test at the beginning of psychotherapy and you find out they have X symptoms. Then maybe you give them a test after several weeks. One of your hopes would be that they have less symptoms. Or let's say that they score less high on those. They may still have the symptom, but they're not nearly as intense as it was before. And you give them a test later on and you find out indeed their improvement is striking. So that, you know, some tests are important because they can measure change. And if you, and it's giving them in sequence that really gives you the information you want. That is, giving them in sequence gives you a lot more information than you might have thought of. Now, the next test that we're going to talk about is called the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, MMPI. This is the most famous of the structured personality tests. That is, this is a test where you have to answer a lot of questions. It was developed actually by a very well-known psychologist at the University of Minnesota named Stark Hathaway and a psychiatrist there named J.C. McKinley. And their goal was to develop a test empirically and that and that a test that they could get scores that would assess various aspects of personality. And the aspects of personality they were interested in were all pathological ones. Now, originally, they took 1,000 items. And then they had clients respond true, if this item was true about them, false, or that they couldn't say. They couldn't decide if this item was true or false about them. And then they took the scores of various people and they compared groups. So they took people that were known to be depressed and they compared their scores with people who were not depressed. They took people who were known to be schizophrenic, compared their scores with people who weren't schizophrenic, so that they could get a sense on these various scales, how many items in a certain category do you have to answer in a certain direction before you really should be seen as pathological. Now, this is very complex, and we don't have enough time yet in our class to go into this. So in the next class, we're going to talk about the MMPI, and we're going to talk about how these scales are formed. We're going to talk about the kind of information that you can get as a clinician from this. We're going to talk about how psychopathology, in a way, has changed in recent times, so that what certain kinds of pathologies that were seen when Hathaway and McKinley came up with this test aren't seen the same way now. And yet the test remains a very, very effective test, a very helpful test. And like all the tests we're talking about, this test has undergone lots of changes. And as we have become more sophisticated in developing scales for this, we're able to answer a lot more questions. So next class, that's what we're going to deal with. And I'll see you then.